You may remember the movie, this dates me, I remember it when it first came out, The Incredible Journey. There was a professor who was going to make a trip. He lived up in Canada and so had a housekeeper that was going to take care of the three animals, two dogs and a cat. So he wrote out a set of instructions, used two sheets of paper, put them up on the mantle, but there still was a fire going in the fireplace. It hadn't quite died out. Well, the cat got up on the mantle of the fireplace and knocked over one of the pages, which went down and burned up. As a result, the housekeeper, as she came in, the last line of the page read, "I am taking the animals." But it was supposed to say, "I'm taking them out for a walk," and then gave instructions for how to care for them. Well, as a result, the housekeeper had no idea that the animals were missing. There were no searches organized, and so by the time they got it all figured out that the animals were missing, they were presumed to be dead. Well, they made an incredible journey and they survived and they got reunited with their family in their other home many, many miles away. There can be major differences that happen as a result of a message being cut short. We're going to look at four places in the Gospel of John where messages are cut short. There are four "where does it end" passages in this Gospel. Does the prologue of the book end at 1:18 or does it end at 1:14? John the Baptist spoke, verse 15 in chapter 1, and your Bible probably has quotation marks around verse 15 only. If you have a Living Water, it extends the quotes through the end of verse 18. So now the question becomes, whose words are verses 16 through 18? Are they those of the Apostle John or John the Baptist? The third passage, John chapter 3, verses 10 through 15, are words spoken by Jesus. As you look in your Bible, you may have your quotation marks end at verse 15. Everyone puts a new paragraph, or virtually everyone puts a new paragraph at verse 16. So now the question becomes, did they start a quotation at verse 16 and continue it to verse 21? Some translations do, some don't. So now the question is, are verses 16 through 21 the words of the Apostle John or of Jesus? And of course, John 3:16, perhaps the most famous verse in the entire Bible. Is this the words of Jesus or is it the words of an apostle? The Baptist spoke, John chapter 3, verses 27 through 30. But then again, where are the quotation marks in various Bibles? Who said verses 31 to 36? The Apostle John or John the Baptist? The outline for this paper, and sorry for the numbering difficulty that I just noticed. No, actually, no, it's fine here. I thought for a moment that there was a typo here as well. We have 6 points we're going to consider. The words are inspired. Does it matter who actually said it? We have many conservative writers that say, well, there may be a debate as to who said these words, but they're still in the Bible and they're still inspired and they're still inerrant. But sometimes, as a result of someone else saying it, it changes the context and the meaning changes. I'm going to be able to illustrate that. It can make a difference in the interpretation. So we are going to argue that yes, it does matter. There was no such thing as quotation marks at the time the New Testament was written. But there are various things that show up that we are calling quote enders. And statistics show that John was quite careful to use quote enders. The next 4 points are the passages that we mentioned earlier. So these are going to be the points that we're going to look at. Carl Laney said, as he was discussing John 3:16 to 21, opinion is divided as to whether this section contains Jesus' teachings or John's reflections. It doesn't really make a great deal of difference one way or the other. So he thinks. The issue can be stated this way. It does matter who said it and when it was said. You'll notice that actually the timing of the statement will be far different if it is written by the supplied by the author, or if it actually originated with the speaker. Let me illustrate. The passages that we are considering are all in John chapters 1 and 3. Now, I hold to a date of crucifixion of the year 33. You may have a different date, so your dates would adjust backward if you held, for example, to a 30 AD crucifixion, but the picture is still going to be the same. I hold to an early date of writing, but there still is a difference between events that are before the cross and the speakers speaking with reference to things as they were 3 years before the cross, as opposed to the apostle writing with a post-crucifixion standpoint and post-resurrection standpoint. So, if John the Baptist spoke John 1, 1 through, 16 through 18, the words date to AD 29. If Jesus spoke 3:16 through 21, those words date to 30. If John the Baptist spoke John 3:31 to 36, those words also date to 30. But if supplied by the apostle, they are post-resurrection words, and it could be argued that the meaning does change. Furthermore, an extremely important thing that occurs in John chapter 3 probably would be taken away from the text if John the Apostle were to supply it. We'll talk about that later. Right now, what I'm going to want to show is that statistics demonstrate that John does use quote enders. He uses things that tell us that the quote has ended, despite the fact that they had no such thing as quotation marks. Now, here we're looking at Codex Washingtonius, which portions of it are an early majority family manuscript. This section of mark, it is not a majority family manuscript, but as you look at the blow-up that's on the right-hand side, you'll notice that it's not very often that there's spacing between words. Normally the words run right together. Sometimes a word will spill over onto a new line and there's no such thing as a hyphen to say, well, this is a word that's continuing. Here and there you'll see some spacing, but you don't see punctuation. All the letters are capitals. So when we are considering how would someone know where quotes begin and where they end, authors had to use other features, things that we don't necessarily think about. We go looking for quotation marks, but since they didn't have them, there were features that an astute reader would notice and be able to discern where a quote ends. Now, quote enders are John's pattern, and you'll notice that Donald Guthrie acknowledges this. Is the first word of his statement, generally in this gospel, that is John, the author distinguishes between Jesus' words and his own. But in this case, and he's talking about John 3, 10 and following, he has omitted to do so. And then he talks about a second one later in the chapter. He says verses 31 and 32 of John 3 are also a comment of John. So he's saying, well, here are two exceptions. But let me summarize the statistics. I have counted 350 quotations in the Gospel of John. I am counting what I call primary direct discourse. What I mean by primary is that it's not like the instances where the disciples said, what did Jesus mean when he said this? And there are some times that of his disciples or even some of his adversaries wrestle over the meaning of what Jesus said, and so they will quote him. That's a secondary quote. But the secondary quote is contained within the quote of either the disciples or of the adversaries. So I don't separately count the secondary quote. I consider what is said by a speaker, even if that speaker is quoting another speaker. The second feature is that I am only counting those things that appear to be direct discourse, as opposed to indirect discourse. We would put quotes if we were saying, the mailman said, you have a package. So, you have a package would go in quotes. On the other hand, I could report what it is that the mailman said as, the mailman said that we have a package. No quotation marks. So we're only considering direct discourse, places where there would be quotation marks. There are 350 quotes, 350 primary direct examples of primary direct discourse. And for at least 347 of them, John has a quote ender. Now, let me clarify this statistic. You remember, we have four passages we are considering. One is the prologue, but the prologue was not spoken by anybody. It is not primary direct discourse. On the other hand, the passage starting at John chapter 1, verse 16, as to whether John has continued his speech through John 1:18, that's one. Second one is, did Jesus continue his speaking John 3:16 through 21, that would be a second one. And our third one would be, did John the Baptist continue his speech into 3:31 through 36? Notice we have three examples. Those are the sole possible exceptions. All of the other quotes in John, people know where it ends because we are able to discern John's quote enders. I think that Donald Guthrie has greatly understated this when he said generally. Doesn't generally sound a little weak for something that occurs at least 347 out of 350 times? I think his statement is rather weak. I would say always in this gospel, the author distinguishes between Jesus' words and his own. Okay, here we go. Here are the 350 uses. I've given them to you as well in your notes. You might want to highlight John 1:18, John 3:21, and John 3:36. Each of the verses that are listed would be the final verse of a quote. So for example, the second one says 19 and 20. There will be one speech that ends in verse 19, and there will be another one that ends in verse 20. If you look at chapter 1, verse 21, you'll notice an A, B, C, and D. There are four quotes, each of which ends within that same verse. So when you add all of these up, it comes up to 350 separate primary direct discourse quotations, and we are looking at the final verse of them in each case. Let me show you what quote enders can look like. You can have a passage that said, they asked, many have the question in quotes, but now it says, he answered them. No one would think that he answered them is part of the quotation by the out of the first speaker. We have a new speaker. There was first speaker in black and a second speaker in red. Well, then we can have a new action. First, we have a quote. John said, and then very next words, the next day, John stood. Well, it's a new action. It's not a quote. This is a complete break from the quote. So even though they didn't have quotation marks, the reader who's paying attention is able to say, I know where this quote ends. Well, then you can have a recap or a summary. You have a quote, as we have in John chapter 8. Jesus said, there's a quote, and then John 8:20, it said, Jesus said this in the treasury of the temple. So when you put something that is clearly not a quote, it serves to say the quotation has ended. No, they didn't have quotation marks. But John is very careful. I would say 350 times out of 350, he tells us that the quote has ended by putting in a quote ender. So in order to save space, to fit it onto my PowerPoint slide, I'm saying the crowd. When I say crowd in each of these, I'm talking about all the commentaries, all the professionals, the overwhelming majority of scholars would end the prologue at John 1:18. We are going to argue that it ends at 1:14. Now let me say that you might wonder, why am I including the prologue in a paper that's mainly about quotations? Well, actually, it's this has a spillover. If we consider verses 15 through 18 to be part of the prologue, we are much less likely to think that John the Baptist would be speaking any more than the bare minimum of what was said. In other words, that's kind of how people get to the position that John the Apostle goes to some trouble to introduce John the Baptist, a speaker. And after he says a few words, he cuts him off. We will argue that the prologue ends at 1:14, and therefore verses 15 and following are part of narrative. So this is actually a first step in arguing where does John the Baptist quotation end. So we'll consider the prologue. It's going to serve double purpose. That I think that there is a clear ending telling us where it ends, and have people that just haven't picked it up. Each of the times that I show one of these passages, you're going to see in black the words that are accepted by everyone as being part or the entirety of either the prologue or the speech. I regard verses 1 through 14 as the prologue. The majority view, though, is that the prologue includes these words that are here in green, going through verse 18. So we're going to look for evidence that the prologue actually ends with verse 14, and that verse 15 starts the narrative of the book. Westcott admits that it's the view that 1:1 through 18 is the prologue is really a beauty queen view. It's basically a popularity contest. He says, though the narrative of St. John's Gospel is not marked off by any very distinct line from the introductory verses, it is generally acknowledged that 1:1 through 18 forms an introduction to the whole work. He said, we really don't see any clues as to where the introductory verses, the prologue, ends. Don't really see where the narrative begins. So I guess I'll just go along with the crowd. The crowd thinks that verses 1 through 18 is the prologue, so they must be right. But notice, he's admitted he doesn't have any solid ground to be able to say there's a stylistic change. There's a feature where John tells us, I am switching gears. The father and son team of Ryken and Ryken are well known as people who analyze literary features in the Bible, and they have noticed many profound things. They're very helpful in many, many ways. In this case, they're helpful because they've made an interesting admission that says that they're befuddled by this passage. After a stately and formal prologue to the book, John 1:1 through 18, we might well be surprised by the abruptness with which John next plunges us into the middle of an action in verse 19. They said, John has worked very, very carefully, and then he just dumps us right into it. And they look at that and they say, after such a good start, we can't figure out how he ended up just kind of dropping the ball at verse 19. Everything changes if you notice some clues. Interestingly, Zane Hodges changed his view. At the time that the majority text was published, he still regarded the prologue as ending at 1:18. I suspect that he was influenced by the person that we're going to quote after this passage, after this citation from Hodges, because the man in question there is someone that Zane respected very highly as a rhetorical critic. What Zane observes here is Jesus is designated as the Word three times in John, 1:1, and once in 1:14, and nowhere else in the book. The appearance of this title in the opening and closing statements of the prologue serves to mark off John 1:1 through 14 as a unit. That is a major argument. This is called an inclusio. And the fact that John introduces Jesus by calling him the Word and never calls him that ever again, very interesting here to look at it. The issue, as we look at the Word there in John 1:1, is it is pointing to his eternality and his existence within the Trinity. But then as you go down to verse 14, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And so it's giving indication that God became man. And after this, he no longer calls him the Word. That's the extent of it. That does give good evidence for this being a unit. So that's first argument for the prologue ending at 1:14. I suspect that George Kennedy may well have had an impact upon Zane Hodges, although I will say that an article that Zane wrote, and we'll be citing from it later on, he wrote the article in 1978, which was about the time that Kennedy wrote New Testament Interpretation According to Rhetorical Criticism. Zane was saying things in that article that logically would lead to the seeing the prologue ending at 1:14, although at that point he had not yet made that transition. Kennedy says, although modern editions, whether English Bibles or Greek Testaments, usually begin a new paragraph at 1:14, this verse begins with a connective, chi, which is usually translated and by conventions of Greek writing should go with the preceding verse. 1:14 is, in fact, the climax of a sequence which leads from the creation to the incarnation. Exactly the thing that Zane pointed out through the inclusio. Verse 15 is the opening of a sequence of three passages, 15 through 18, 19 through 28, 29 through 36. We might divide it up a little differently than Kennedy, but he's on the right track. So I continue in gray with what he said, that it is, in fact, the climax of a sequence which leads from the creation to the incarnation. Verse 15 is the opening of a sequence of three passages which elaborate and thus support John's thought. Verses 15 through 18 demonstrate intuitive judgment, and he has a discussion. 19 through 28 demonstrate the evidence from prophecy, continuing discussion. And verses 29 through 36 resume the intuitive judgment. So he's saying, he sees the prologue serving to introduce this opening section within the body of the book. Let's look at what Zane said when he was launching into his analysis of John 1:15 and following. The prologue has brought the reader to the incarnation of the eternal Word. The reader is now to be introduced via the testimonies of the Baptist, Andrew, Philip, and Nathaniel. So notice how we're tying in what Kennedy just said to the historical and human person that the Word has become. So the Word starts out as God and only God, and then through the incarnation is the God-man who has come to planet Earth and is interacting with these people, and these are early disciples of his, launching us into the argument of the entire book. So, that now brings us to how most of the literature ends John the Baptist's quotation at 1:15. But actually, John spoke all the way through verse 18. So notice, John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, "This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. And of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him." Now you'll notice that I have used the quotation marks that were supplied by the King James Version. I would say the quotes go around the entire passage, not just verse 15. Right, look at how long that introduction is. John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, and then we have just a very, very short quote. If the common handling of this is correct. Zane argued back in 1978 that it made much better sense for John the Baptist to be the speaker of the entirety of this passage, all the way through verse 18. We'll talk about some of those issues here. First, there is no quote ender in 1:16. Nothing does what John normally does when he says, "I'm ending a quote." He will put something in there that makes it very clear that there is not a continuation of that speech. But there is a quote ender in 1:19, saying that 1:18 is the end. We're going to look at the chronology of Jesus' baptism and temptation. There have been many who have misunderstood that chronology, and that goes a long way towards misunderstanding where John's speech ends. This chronology explains the repetition of the thought of 1:15 in 1:27 and 1:30. Also, John the Baptist, a God-sent prophet, knew of Jesus Christ's eternality. Lots of writers, including ones that one might expect to be conservative, deny that John knew of Jesus' eternality, and they explain it as, well, he was just born superior to me, with no thought of there being an eternality of one who is physically younger, 6 months younger than John the Baptist. And then the question becomes how to define "we all" in 1:16. This is another place where the interpretation of the passage determines on, was it spoken early? Was it spoken in the year 29? Or are these the words of the apostle after the cross and resurrection? Well, first, there's no quote ender in 1:16, and this is that article from 1978. The text of verses 15 through 18 reads naturally if taken as the words of John the Baptist. The author certainly gives no overt clue that the speaker he has introduced in verse 15 suddenly ceases to speak in the following verses. When we think about John using quote enders at least 347 times out of 350, the burden of proof is upon those who would say, verses 16, 17, and 18 are not meant to be the quote, even though John gave no indication that the Baptist's words cease. And so Let's look at verse 19. Those wishing to end John's speech at 1:15 deny the existence of a, quote, ender. That is, they say, there isn't any such thing here at the end of verse 15 or at the beginning of verse 16. But I would say in response, no, there is a clear, quote, ender, and that's in verse 19. Since John places, quote, enders at the end of at least 347 of his 350 quotes, the burden of proof is upon those wishing to end the quote early. Notice 1:19, and this is the testimony of John. There is no way that those are words given by John the Baptist. That is a quote ender. That says, quote has ended, but it ends here, not and 1:16. Now, what we're going to look at this point is the chronology. And as we look at chronology, we have the same set of verses in John that would be day X, and there's going to be a reason for day X, because is day X the first day or is it the second day of a sequence? That's an open question. But then you have the day after that, the day after that, the day after that, and then you have the third day. So you'll notice my two red arrows. The arrow that is pointing to the left, there are many people, a very large number of people, including such respected ones as Kurt Aland with his gospel synopsis, that would put the baptism of Jesus during the day 1:29 to 34. I will argue that that cannot be when Jesus' baptism happened. His baptism has to be before John 1:15. So we put it at day X minus 1, the arrow pointing to the right. So the big question here is, where do we put the baptism of Jesus? That will have some important interpretive issues that rely upon it. It also is going to affect inerrancy. This is significant. Now, this is a place where Westcott got it right. He has a couple of things that he points out. He says the baptism itself had already taken place before the mission from Jerusalem. That would be John 1:19 through 28. In other words, he's saying that it happened in day X minus at least one. Here is his evidence. First, the record of time, verses 29 and 35, etc. That's where it says the next day, the next day, the next day. We'll talk about that argument a little later. The next slide that we're going to go to is going to consider argument 2A and 2B. His reasoning extends for the reason for having to see the chronology in this way is from the fact that the Baptist already knew Jesus as the Christ, verse 26. Whom ye know not. Compare verse 33, where John, prior to baptizing Jesus, did not know him as a Messiah. So this next argument relies upon, when did John come to recognize that Jesus was the Messiah? Well, let's see. Let me see. Okay, I'm going to have to add a slide here. Okay, this is actually going to his first argument. You'll notice that John tells us the next day, the next day, the next day. Take a look at John chapter 1, verse 29, the next day. Verse 35, again the next day, verse 43, the following day, and then 2:1, on the third day, and the most natural way to handle that would be the day after the next day. So we have a series of days. But if the baptism of Jesus happened during the day of 1:29 to 34, we have a huge problem. Because Mark 1:9 through 11 talks about Jesus' baptism. And then he came out of the water, and verse 12 says, and immediately after the baptism in 1:11, the Spirit drove him into the wilderness 40 days tempted by Satan. So how can you have the next day, even though Jesus has to go immediately to be tempted for 40 days? The only way to resolve this is that the baptism of Jesus is prior to the start of John's narrative. Now, let's back up here to the previous slide and look at argument for 2a and 2b. If you look in John chapter 1, verse 26, he says, I baptize with water, but there stands one among you. He doesn't say there will stand. He says there stands. I believe that Jesus was present on that very day. Jesus has not yet given John permission to introduce him, but John knows he's there. And he's one that you don't know, but I know him. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to say that one that's standing there is the Messiah. I mean, what he says in verse 27 makes it very clear that he's saying there is someone standing among you that's really, really special. That is, he's the Messiah. Is he who coming after me is preferred before me, whose sandal strap I'm not worthy to loose. Well, then we drop down to verse 33, and John says, I did not know him, but he who sent me to baptize with water said to me, upon whom you see the Spirit descending and remaining upon him, this is he who baptizes with the Holy Spirit. When did the Spirit descend upon Jesus and remain on him? At his baptism. John says, I didn't know the day before I baptized him that he was the Messiah. But in verse 26, which is the day before, verses 29 through 34, notice verse 29 says the next day, John already knew who Jesus was. That requires that what he's talking about in verses 32 and 33, of I saw the Spirit descending from heaven like a dove and he remained upon him, but I didn't know him. He's looking back to the time that he baptized Jesus. So therefore, the baptism and the temptation necessarily happen prior to the start of John's narrative in 1:15. The baptism cannot go at this point. It cannot be inserted into the day of John 1:29 through 34, even though some respected people have put it there. So we have a sequence here. John baptized Jesus. There are the passages in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Then Jesus was tempted for 40 days. We have the passages in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He returned from the desert, came to see John the Baptist. John the Baptist recalls what he's been saying over these 40 days. He's been talking about Jesus while Jesus is away being tempted. Then we have our series of passages. That makes it so that John 1:29 through 34 is thinking back to an event a couple of months prior. So, that is going to set it up for how we are going to answer McGregor in argument 2c. why is John 1:15 repeated in 1:27 and 30? Let's look at those three verses. John 1:15. John says, "This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me." Then we look at 1:27. "It is he who coming after me is preferred before me, whose sandal strap I am not worthy to loose." And then we look at verse 30. "This is he of whom I said, after me comes a man who is preferred before me, for he was before me." Lots and lots of scholars puzzle over 1:15. And they say, "Oh, this has got to be John the Apostle's reflection, and he just decided to drop it in there, even though it comes up again." So, he says, "The testimony of the Baptist in 1:15 seems rather superfluous anticipation of 27 and 30. It is not clear to what prior occasion the Baptist refers to in the words, 'This was he of whom I said.' The verse is almost certainly interpolated by the redactor." So he says, the Apostle John just stuck words on papyrus. But let's see what is said by a couple of other New Testament people, Comfort and Hawley. "This verse seems to interrupt," that is 1:15, "the flow of the narrative. The writer must have had a reason for placing this testimony from John the Baptist here, a testimony which is repeated in its logical, chronological order in 1:30. Said, it belongs in 1:30. What was John the Apostle thinking of when he decided to stick it here too? Well, they have essentially denied that John the Baptist may repeat key assertions. So, let's look at this. In 1:15, the Baptist recalls his ongoing message. Jesus is away being tempted, and he said, "You know, I've been saying all along, I'm a nobody, he's greater than I am." Then we have a delegation that comes from Jerusalem, and he tells them, "I'm a nobody, Jesus is everybody." As they were trying to say, "What kind of important role do you claim for yourself since you're baptizing?" And he said, "I'm a nobody, Jesus is the one that's important, the coming one." He didn't name him to them. "The coming one is greater than I am. I'm a nobody." And then in 1:30, it is John the Baptist giving that message to his disciples. What John the Apostle is telling us, this is such an important issue that John is always emphasizing it. These are separate occasions, but John the Apostle is telling us that John the Baptist really made a point of, "I'm a nobody. Jesus is everything." So when we figure out this chronology, all of a sudden it makes sense. Now the question here becomes, John the Baptist is a prophet. Jesus in Matthew 11 and Luke 7 called John the Baptist a prophet and more than a prophet. Well, one of the features of a prophet is that they receive revelation from God. And remember how in John 1:33 that John the Baptist said that he was informed of a very clear way to recognize the coming one, that the Spirit would descend upon him. John is a prophet. He receives revelation from God. But you know, all the accounts, all the gospel accounts make it clear that God appointed him. How would John know that he was appointed by God unless God had given him direct revelation? Yes, John was a prophet. But despite this, scholarship, even conservative scholarship, downplays how much the Baptists knew rather than letting the text speak. The tendency in New Testament scholarship is to say, well, John spoke better than he knew. They think that he is totally in the dark. It is my impression, by contrast, that John would not have been able to carry out his ministry effectively without knowing that Jesus was infinitely superior to himself. It's not just that he's twice the man, like was the case with Elisha versus Elijah, the double portion of the Spirit. John saying, I am a nobody. How is he going to recognize that? One of the best ways is for God to reveal just how stupendous a being Jesus Christ is. And one of those features is communicating to John that Jesus is an eternal being. How we approach this has been affected by punctuation that is motivated in many cases by people's analysis where they say, it can't be that John knew this. There's no way John can know this. They deny effectively that he was a prophet and that God revealed truth to him. They think that he just learned it gradually over time, and so John is so early he couldn't know very much. That's wrong. Well, here's Colin Cruz. He says, there are no indications that John was aware of Jesus' pre-existence as the Word. It may be that John the Baptist only meant to say that Jesus surpassed him because he was always greater than him. John the Baptist spoke better than he knew. Not at all. The only reason that Cruz thinks that there are no indications of this is that he cannot imagine John at this early date knowing these things, because he can't imagine him as a prophet that receives revelation directly from God. But look at what Zane Hodges said. John the Baptist shows himself to possess a superlative insight into the person of Christ. But this is hardly surprising for so great a prophetic figure as John was, and it is indeed what might be expected from Messiah's forerunner who precedes him in the spirit and power of a new Elijah. Verses 16 through 18 can easily be ascribed to John the Baptist if it is recognized that he genuinely possessed the faculty of a prophet. Here we have Frederick Godet saying, well, we all seems to mean we all, the church, and the church didn't come about until Acts chapter 2, and that's long after John the Baptist has died and so on and so forth. So let's look at what John 1:16 says. And of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace. Now, Jesus hasn't even begun his ministry. So how is John able to say this? Well, I'm sure that John has had conversation with Jesus. After all, he's able to say that there's one standing among you very shortly that you don't know, but I do. He's had conversations with Jesus. He had conversations undoubtedly that extend beyond what's recorded in the synoptics at Jesus' baptism. But besides that, he's one who's receiving direct revelation from God. we all. It says the we all of verse 16, which implies the existence of the church, in any case excludes the supposition that John the Baptist is still speaking in verse 16. Okay, fair enough if that's what we all means. But what would we all mean if John the Baptist were speaking it? The nation Israel. Israel has had grace showered upon it ever since the call of Abram. And Israel has been naughty. It's gotten into a lot of trouble. You look throughout the Old Testament, and Israel was always in the fire, but never consumed. It's something like the burning bush, which sort of illustrated God's relationship with Israel. Always burning, never consumed. And wave after wave after wave of grace kept being extended to a nation that, if there had not been those covenants, would there be any reason to expect that Israel would have continued? St. Hodges says, if John the Evangelist is speaking, the reference to of his fullness, we all receive grace upon grace, is the experience of the Christian church. But if John the Baptist is the speaker, then the reference will be to the experience of Israel. The interpretation is affected by when it is said and by whom it is said. So we see, as we look over the arguments, there's no quote ender in 116, but there is in 119. We saw that there's a chronology of Jesus' baptism and temptation that then explains the chronology of why it would be that 115 is repeated, because John was emphasizing, I'm a nobody. Jesus is everything. He's greater than I am. He pre-existed me. He's greater in all ways. And John the Baptist was a God-sent prophet, quite capable of receiving revelation saying that Jesus is an eternal being. And we all would be Israel. So the problems that are raised by those that say it couldn't possibly be John the Baptist speaking after verse 15 are weak arguments. This now brings us to our biggest passage of the quotation starting at John 3:10. Almost all of scholarship wants to end it at 3:15, but it does end at 3:21. Interestingly, many translations continue the quote of all the way forward. New King James puts a beginning quote at each verse that's continuing, so you'll notice in verse 10, are you the teacher, starts with quote, but then verse 11, most assuredly, they have quotes at the end, at the start of verses, but they don't have at the end. The only verse that has it at the end is verse 21. New King James is saying the entirety here is a quote. But we have those that think that only verses 10 through 15 were stated by Jesus and everything after that was added by John the Apostle. First, we're going to see 22 versions that end Jesus' speech at 21. And then we have a series of arguments, a shift from dialogue to monologue may seem abrupt. There is a lack of first-person self-references by Jesus. There are past tenses that seem to some to be problematic. Verse 22 is a quote-ender, but there are no quote-enders at 16. And Jesus' whole argument involves the Trinity. Here's a list of 22 versions, and there are others, but these are the ones that I've pulled up that use quotation marks. Now, the Old King James did not use quotation marks, so it's hard to know, and you might say, but I can look at a red letter edition of the King James. This is true, but the red letter ink was decided upon by modern editors. They didn't do that back in the days of King James. So we don't exactly know how they took it, if they recognized the transitions to be adverse quote enders, or whether they might have had a different standard. We can only speculate. Well, there's a back and forth dialogue, and then all of a sudden it becomes a long speech by Jesus. And Leon Morris says, somewhere that's got to end, because monologue is not going to be there. The shift is telling us, no, it's John the Apostle, not Jesus. So he says it is difficult to know where they, the evangelist's meditations, begin and end. He doesn't recognize quote enders. There were no devices like quotation marks, but what about quote enders? To show the precise limits of quoted speech, we must work out for ourselves where a speech or quotation ends. He says, this is a do-it-yourself job. The dialogue form simply ceases. Most agree that somewhere we pass into the reflections of the evangelist, perhaps, oh, such certainty. The dividing point comes at the end of verse 15. He does not have something he can point to say, here is a clear demarcation. It's do it yourself. Well, C.H. Dodd has a critique. He said, the first of the two discourses, second one is going to be the one by John the Baptist. And so here he's considering Jesus speaking in the first part of John 3. The first of the two discourses takes the form of a dramatic dialogue, passing into a monologue from that point on. Various attempts have been made to determine at what point the conversation with Nicodemus is supposed to end and a fresh exposition to begin. But in fact, although the discourse wanders from the immediate point of rebirth, there is continuity down to 3:21. The transition from dialogue to monologue is characteristic of this writer's manner. He said, there's nothing surprising here. Interestingly, nowhere else in John's Gospel is there a long quotation by Jesus that has followed some dialogue that people struggle with. This is the only one. So when Dodd says this is characteristic, virtually everyone would have to agree with that. They just say, this is an exception. And we have a second response. Those claiming that the shift from dialogue to monologue marks the end of Jesus' speech have a glaring inconsistency. The shift to monologue occurs at 3:10, but oddly, those who cut the speech treat either 3:10 through 12 or 3:10 through 15 as part of Jesus' speech. They do not really view the switch to monologue as proof that Jesus has stopped speaking, because it became monologue in verse 10. But nobody makes short little snippets and then relegates the rest to monologue. Some ended at 12, some ended at 15. They have an inconsistency here. In other words, they raise an objection, but then they fall into the trap that they say is the problem for our view. Next, we have some past tense forms that cause some people, like Bernard, problems. But it would seem that John does not mean to place verses 16 through 21 in the mouth of Jesus. These verses are rather reflections and comments by the evangelist on the words which he has already ascribed to Jesus in the discourse with Nicodemus. The dialogue framework has dropped. Past tenses, forgave, sent, has come, are used, as would be natural if the writer is meditating on the great events of the past. Basically, he has a problem with, he thinks that Jesus has introduced the cross here in the book. I wouldn't have a problem with Jesus introducing the cross. In fact, of necessity, when he talks about Moses lifting up the serpent in 3:14, he is alluding, because he says the Son of Man must also be lifted up. But let's look at this. God loved the world by giving his one and only Son, so that whoever believes in him should not perish. Is the giving talking about the cross, or is it talking about the incarnation? Well, the incarnation was a past event at the time of John 3. That's the first of those past tense verbs that Bernard had problems with. Second past tense was the word send in verse 17. For God did not send his Son into the world to judge the world. Reference of sending is to the incarnation. This is not an anachronism. The incarnation has been presented very early in Jesus' ministry. This is the judgment that light has come into the world. That's a reference to the incarnation. That's not a problem. Okay, then what about, instead of saying I, that Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, or he refers to himself as he, and so on and so forth. So, and surely the third person discourse signals only begotten Son, believes in him, that here, if not before, in 3:13 through 15, we are meant to ask, or to think, that we are listening to the voice of the evangelist speaking about the significance of Jesus as the Nicodemus story reveals it. In other words, the third person references sound like John talking about Jesus instead of Jesus talking about Jesus. However, Jesus refers to himself 68 times in 39 verses with various third-person forms, whether Greek pronouns, participles, third-person verbs, or nouns like the Son, and so on and so forth. Furthermore, Jesus refers to himself with third-person forms in 3:13 through 15. Wait a moment. Ben Witherington sees verses 13 through 15 where Jesus refers to himself with third-person forms as being part of Jesus' speech. So how can this be an objection? This is not unusual speech. So, then we have what I regard as the biggest argument. Francois Routon offered an insightful outline of John 3, 1 to 21 in 1956. It's an introduction, verses 1 and 2. Part 1, born of the Spirit. Holy Spirit is the only member of the Trinity mentioned in verses 3 through 8. Part 2, the mediation of the Son, 3:19 through 15. Part 3, the saving plan of the Father, where he sent the Son. And then there's a conclusion. This passage brings up the Trinity. I'd like to have you take a look at something in John chapter 3 that is fascinating. In John 3, as Jesus is speaking with Nicodemus and those who are with him, there are plurals in the passage that are most naturally explained with the idea that Nicodemus brought some of his disciples with him. So I'll translate verse 12 of John 3 that way. If I have told y'all earthly things, and y'all do not believe, how will y'all believe if I tell y'all heavenly things? Now, what would be a more heavenly truth that would be beyond the capability of those with Nicodemus, and this one would absolutely be a new one for Nicodemus as well, that there's God the Spirit, God the Son, and God the Father, and all working in concert, and this is in the concept that there's only one God. Talk about a heavenly truth that they're not ready for. This is it. Now, something fascinating. Look at Nicodemus' opening statement in John 3:2. Rabbi, we, probable reference to those that he's brought with him, know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these things that you do unless God is with him. At this point, he hasn't understood who Jesus is, but he understands that he's from God. He understands he needs to come to grips with what it is that Jesus is saying. Well, if we get up to verse 15, Jesus has affirmed that he's come from heaven. And we would recognize him. If he's come from heaven, it's with the Father's blessing. But up to this point, up to verse 15, all that Jesus has said is that I've come from heaven. But what was it that Nicodemus said? We know that you are a teacher come from God. In other words, God, we know that God sent you. It's not until verses 16 and 17 that Jesus affirms everything that Nicodemus said in his opening statement. He says that God gave him, verse 16, for God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but he sent him that the world through him might be saved. Those who deny that these verses are a part of the passage are ripping out a very important aspect of the argument. Jesus is presenting the whole Trinity. Now, I'd like you to turn to the appendix, back page of your notes. And what you'll see there is that we have verses in John that don't mention any member of the Trinity. That's the first set. We have those verses that mention only one member of the Trinity. It could be the Father only, the Son only, the Spirit only. Then we have verses, point three, that mention two members of the Trinity, the Father and the Son, the Father and the Spirit, the Son and the Spirit. But finally, we have point four, seven verses that mention all three members of the Trinity. I'd like for you to notice that one of those is in John 1:33, spoken by John the Baptist. Look back up there. I did not know him, but he who sent me to baptize with water said to me, as the Father speaking, upon whom you see the Spirit descending and remaining upon him, this is he who baptizes with the Holy Spirit. One has to say, with the number of passages that mention two members of the Trinity and those that mention three, and the fact that those mentions even happen in chapter one, that a presentation of issues surrounding the Trinity is a very important feature. It's not that just that Jesus came. It is that he was sent. He was sent by the Father. But the apostles would be obliged to tell people the truth that receives a lot of attention in John, that now that Jesus has ascended to heaven, that the Holy Spirit is carrying on functions that Jesus did, so that he hasn't left believers as orphans. So the Trinity is an important aspect of all this that's going on. It's an important part of the message that people aren't thinking, well, yeah, okay, Jesus left. What a mess. No, it's still under God's control. This is an evangelistic book, but it is making quite a concerted effort to bring a lot of clarity to the inner workings between the members of the Trinity. And I do not find it at all surprising that Jesus would, in a clouded way, start introducing the Trinity here to some people who are wanting more information about him. So, we've seen 22 versions, we've seen that the shift from dialogue to monologue may seem abrupt, but it's part of John's style, and those who raise it as an issue end up having some of the monologue in the portions that they assign to Jesus, so they're not consistent. Same can be said for the lack of first-person self-references. That's a feature that happens often in John, and the people who say that's a problem end up usually having some of those references that they claim that Jesus said here, in at least up through verse 13. The past tense forms are not a problem. The quote enders at 322, it is not at 316. And look at the development that happens about the Trinity. Yeah, this makes a difference. Now the final passage is John the Baptist quotation. Does it end at 330? No, it ends at 336. So here in black is the portion that everyone's willing to assign to John the Baptist. That in green is more controversial, but it was stated by John. These are John's words, and it is in the verse that follows, 4:1, that we have the quote ender that makes it clear. That's where the quote ends. There's nothing indicating a transition in the middle of this passage. So the first one, there are no quote enders at 331. Again, third person self-reference are common, and the present tense verbs in 332 favor the Baptist as speaker. Hoskins mentions a French writer, Lagrange, who by the way spells it with a lowercase g, treats them, that is John 3:31 to 36, as reflections which the evangelist added to his record of the witness of John. But neither are they out of place where they are, nor does there seem to be any discernible break at verse 30. There's no quote ender there. Again, third first reference are common within the book. I have not yet tracked down third person reference to other speakers. That is something that I plan to do. Now, the present tense verbs in verse 32. Let's look at that verse before we talk about it. Jesus is superior to John. That's what John is telling his own disciples who are complaining because everyone is going to him. And so one of the things that he says is verse 32, and what he, Jesus, has seen and heard, that he testifies, not that he testified, and no one receives his testimony. And so the way that it's presented, it sounds like a contemporary speaker. Besides that, there are no quote enders. So Pickering says, there are differing opinions about where the baptizer's speech ends. The rest would then be a commentary by the author, John. The verbs in the present tense in verse 32, and to what he has seen and heard, he testifies. yet no one receives his testimony. Tip the decision in favor of the baptizer. The apostle John would have had to use a past tense. So, no quote enter appears. Verse 31, the present tense verbs. In verse 32, favor of the Baptist speaker. So, we've seen that it really does matter. The words are inspired, but it still matters who and when it was spoken. The statistics show that John does use quote-enders at least 347, I would argue 350 times out of his 350 primary direct discourse quotes. We've had people who want to end all of these early, at a different place. The prologue they like to extend, and so that one should end at 114, because 115 is where the quote ender appears. The rest of them are to be extended. Like we saw, the message changed when that second page of the note dropped into the fireplace and the housekeeper read it saying, I've taken the animals. Without the understanding, I've taken them for a walk. So, John uses quote extenders, I would say 350 of 350 times. When text critics speak of missing quote enders, they actually have rejected the quote ender that's there. It just happens to be a few verses later than where they want to end the quote. They have not taken John's word for where the quote ends. They have done do-it-yourself. They suggesting that cutting a quote short eliminates anachronisms, like we all, as a reference to the church. When John wouldn't have meant it that way, the Baptist would have been speaking about Israel has been a recipient of wave after wave after wave of God's grace. They think it resolves interpretive or stylistic issues, but we saw that it ends up with messing up both of those. They only solve imaginary problems while creating new ones. Okay, questions.